Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Emmanuel Daniel, who is the founder of The Asian Banker, and we discuss the intersection of global finance and geopolitics. Hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Emmanuel, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on, and you're joining us from Singapore today, so there's a really nice international flavour to the conversation today.
Great to be on your show, Chris. I'm looking forward to this because I come from finance going into geopolitics, and you're from geopolitics, you know, making this foray into finance and how that sort of meet each other, so yeah.
Yes. Just for listeners, Emmanuel and I will just have a quick chat off air. The world of finance is out of my comfort zone, so this is definitely not an area of my expertise in the slightest. So forgive me, anybody listening who thinks I'm asking some really stupid questions today. I hope I'm not. But just kicking off then, Emmanuel, I suppose, could you just tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to kind of focus on that intersection of finance and geopolitics and emerging technologies?
So, Chris, I'm the founder of The Asian Banker, and that was in 1996, you know, after having graduated in law and all of that. And I used that to travel around the region from country to country, meet the top bankers in each country. I call banking the cathedral industry. Outside of government, this is the large industry that sits in the middle of town. It's like a cathedral. You know, everyone has something to do with banking from the time they're born to the time they die. And when I land in any of these countries, I get to meet some of the most important people in the country. And so, so that was like a, you know, an adventure sort of. And in the process, I built the Asian Banker into becoming the most respected provider of banking intelligence across the Asia Pacific region, where there wasn't any such transparent assessment of the banking industry in the region. And then in 2000, I started an office in Shanghai first, and then 2004 in Beijing. And in 2001, China joined the WTO. And because we were foreign to China, I became friends with the chairman of the largest banks in China, you know, the top regulators. They were learning as well, and they invited us to come in and, you know, show them what the rest of the world was doing and all of that. So I had a front seat view of the rise of China, you know, from 2000 to what it is today. And I've seen the iteration evolve over time. And then through that, very interestingly, because we were called the Asian Banker, you know, we had any number of U.S. and European, you know, regulators, congressmen coming to Asia, and every time they came, they would speak at our conferences, and many of them became my friends. And Barney Frank, Congressman Barney Frank, who was the head of the chairman of the banking subcommittee in Congress, became a very dear friend. He wrote the forward to my book on the future of finance. And then as we grew into Africa and the Middle East, we morphed into what we are called today, which is TAB Global, which is the Asian Banker Global. And in the process, it's inevitable that because I meet all of these important people, there is a geopolitical element in there. And sometimes when I see some of the discussions in geopolitics, I realize that many people in geopolitics don't understand understand the financial capital markets aspect that drives geopolitics. And so that's my contribution to the industry, and that's where I come from.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. You've written a book called The Great Transition that explores the evolution of global finance. I suppose, could you briefly explain the kind of core thesis of it and what sparked your interest in writing that book?
Because of the, you know, the time I've spent in banking, I understand the technologies that are shaping the industry. But at the same time, I looked under the hood and took a view in terms of the geopolitics, if you want, but policies and, you know, societal processes that causes transformation in finance. And so just tracking how finance itself is evolved, finance used to be this one huge bank, sitting in the center of your city with a lot of processes and technology behind it. And all of us has something to do with it. And it used to be that you had to sit outside the bank for it to be open at 9 o'clock in the morning. Today, you do banking when you want on your mobile phone. You know, many of us have never been to the bank. So the title of my book was The Great Transition, The Personalization of Finance is Here, meaning the industry's technology is allowing the individual to take greater ownership of his relationship with his money, with his relationship with his counterparties, and with his relationship with an institution called the banking industry. And so the banking industry has to morph and rethink its role as an intermediary, its role as a functionary between a man and his money. The reason banks have a dominant role in society is because they are licensed institutions. And the reason for that is because society just needs to deal with a trusted institution. So now we track how banking is evolving with the advent of, you know, new technologies like cryptocurrencies, for example, which enables two people, you and me, to transact with each other without an intermediary in the middle. Then, you know, what is the role of the intermediary? And tracking that, you realize that there is still a need for a trusted intermediary, and therefore the regulators need to ensure that they function and pay attention to a number of elements. Know your customer, anti-money laundering, all of that, and safety and security. At the same time, they're absorbing the new technologies and enabling the end user to do whatever he wants. Now, the interesting thing there is that even as I think about finance and the evolution of finance through all of these innovations, it's having an incredible impact on society itself. And so I start the book by talking about finance. So the cover of my book has a picture of an ice cube in there. And so I try to keep it as simple as possible by explaining to people that ice cubes used to be something that you saw out of a lake and put it on horse-drawn carriages to take it to the town to have it in your gin and tonic. But today, ice is something that you manufacture when you want it in a refrigerator. And so that's finance today, which is well within your control. So I use simple metaphors like that and help people understand where finance is going. But at the same time, I find that I have to take a view on what causes, what triggers the innovation points in finance. And there, and then in the middle of the book, I start taking a historical perspective and start looking at which points were innovations in finance triggered. And the conclusion that I came to is that innovations only ever happen in times of crisis, in times of need. And then I start to piece together how innovation will evolve over into the future. So that's the main thesis of the book.
Thank you for that. I'm just going to move us into looking at the future of the US dollar and its economic power. So how secure is the US dollar's role as a global reserve currency today? And could the rise of digital currencies that you just mentioned shift us towards a more multipolar system?
So as I was saying, innovations in finance and the financial infrastructure that we have today was driven more by crises and moments of despair than out of intent or design. And so when we think about the dollar as being the reserve currency of the world, it didn't happen out of design. There were no white papers in the Federal Reserve banking system saying we need to internationalize the dollar. The dollar became internationalized after World War II. Well, it was already international then. It was the reference currency for trade, you know, and all of the economists in the Western world subscribed to the idea that the dollar should be predicated or tagged to the value of gold. And the value of gold at that time was actually the value as prescribed by Isaac Newton in his time. So, you know, it was an ancient regime of the banking system. But after World War II, as the U.S. helped Europe to rebuild itself through the Marshall Plan and all of that, there came the need to garner dollars because that was the currency in which all of Europe was selling to the U.S. And paying its debt and all of that. And a lot more of the dollar became internationalized. Now, when we think about the future of the dollar, we need to look for similar mechanisms in the evolution of any other alternatives that are coming about today. And to be honest, there are no currencies that come close to the dominance that the dollar has built for itself, not by design, but through history, through accidents of events. And as the dollar floating outside of the U.S. Became larger than the dollar floating in the U.S., it lent itself as a desirable mechanism by which the U.S. government was able to issue indeterminate debt forever and ever, as long as there were buyers of U.S. dollars and U.S. Treasury assets outside of the U.S. And as it turned out, because of the quality of the U.S. government in terms of its ability to keep its commitment to pay its debt on time and all of that, and also of the resilience of the U.S. economy, it continued to grow. It continued its ability to buy from the rest of the world. And the rest of the world was being paid in dollars, which then got reinvested in the U.S. The role of the dollar became increasingly dominant. Now, the U.S. government itself does not take a position on the value of the dollar or the function of the dollar outside of the U.S. And in fact, that's one of the operating principles that, and you know, to put it bluntly, this is what I tell the Chinese and the Europeans: the U.S. government doesn't care about what happens to the dollar outside of the U.S., whereas the Chinese care only too much about, you know, who can short the renminbi and have access to it outside of China. And the euro also has, the eurozone also has its safety bearings in place. You know, we've been through that period where the pound, sterling pound, and several other currencies were shorted, by hedge funds and so on. So you need to be large enough for the economy of a country not to worry about your currency being shorted or manipulated outside of your economy. It's a chicken and egg. You need to be large enough for you to have that exorbitant privilege, as it were. And when you're large enough, all you need to do, strangely enough, is to keep issuing debt so that you create more liquidity, among the countries that hold your securities, hold your currency and all of that. Now, what's happening today is that a number of countries are willfully, consciously reducing their holding of treasury bonds, especially China. And that is sometimes used as an indicator to suggest that the U.S. dollar or U.S. treasury bonds will lose their reserve value to other countries and to other central banks. It is still a work in progress in that both sovereign investors and corporate investors don't just take a policy view as to the assets that they invest in. In other words, I'm not investing in you because I don't like you. If the dollar or treasury assets continue to provide the best return on investment, all of the sovereigns around the world will keep going back to the dollar as an investable asset. So, it's not a zero-sum game in that I like you, I buy from you, I don't like you. I have to see what else is out there in the marketplace. What is interesting is that as long as the U.S. continues to be a highly competitive economy and provides value for anyone holding the dollar, and right now, the U.S. equities market, for example, it represents about, just about 10 big stocks represent about half of the global equity market. So you have no choice if you are thinking about making sure that you get best return on investment on the dollars that you hold. And so as long as the U.S. economy keeps being competitive and making huge breakthroughs in technology, in innovation, and in productivity, the U.S. will continue to be an attractive investment destination. Just by its sheer size and depth, there are no alternatives. And it's nothing to do with the geopolitics of whether countries want to deal with each other. So, one of the reasons this whole question of the future of the dollar came about was when Russia attacked Ukraine, many countries saw how the U.S., the Federal Reserve System, especially the Federal Reserve Bank office in New York, was able to monitor all of the dollar transactions going through its system and put a halt on transactions emanating from Russia. So many countries said to themselves, countries in the South were saying to themselves, if the U.S. could do this to Russia, they could do it to us. So let's start looking for alternatives. In all likelihood, on the trade front, there is a credible new process coming into place where countries are buying and selling to each other on a bilateral basis using their respective currencies. But this is not becoming multilateral in that, you don't have a case of 10 countries getting together and agreeing to use an alternative currency. And anyone who tells me that there is something new that's coming through, like the renminbi, for example, that might well be a replacement to the dollar, I will say to them that remember the euro. It was supposed to be an alternative to the dollar. It never went up to more than 10% of global trade. And the euro was the second largest economy in the world. And there are reasons for that. And understanding those reasons will help us to draft an idea of how that will evolve over time. And today, we have new evolutions taking place in finance, where because of digital technology and because of stable coins, there is a theory that the dollar can extend its usefulness in the economy by being part of the digital economy, which is to put the dollar into stable coins. And the interesting thing is that of all the stable coins circulating around the world today, 80% of that is dollar. So even on that front, the dollar has already established its preeminence. So just looking at the evolutions as they take place, I'm tracking this very carefully and I follow every commentary saying that, maybe the BRICS countries are going to create their own alternative. And then when I drill into the BRICS countries at the Kazan conference last year in Russia, the BRICS summit, the communique specifically says that they are not thinking about a BRICS currency, and they can't because basically, the BRICS countries don't trust each other in terms of their respective fiscal policies in order to come up with an agreement on a common platform. So that's a non-starter for now. If something happens that countries start to trust each other outside of the dollar-denominated system, then we need to pay attention to that and see how that evolves.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. Hey everybody, it's Chris here. I hope you're well. Have you ever wanted to run one of your own podcasts? Well, on Monday the 22nd of September, I'll be running a one-day workshop with my friend Jeff, who runs a Doctor Who podcast called Who Corner to Corner. And we'll be looking at the basics of podcasting and empowering you to make your own podcast. So join us on Monday the 22nd of September. The link is in the show notes below. One question I'm just going to ask very briefly is what role President Trump's sort of tariffs play in the international economy today, and whether that kind of creates a threat to the US dollar in the long run or the short term?
In fact, only today, some of the US quarterly results were out. And the prognosis is that Trump's tariffs are beginning to show on US corporate results. And the way in which it is showing is that the corporation, U.S. corporations are absorbing the tariff, and therefore their margins are being reduced, and therefore their quarterly performance has been moribund. And if this keeps continuing, U.S. corporations will then have to pass on the cost of the tariffs to the end user. So it was, when we talk tariff, it wasn't ever an attack on the other guy. It was always an attack on your own buyers. Someone put it to me this way, saying that actually the actual choice would have been a goods and services tax or a consumption tax on the people. It would have had exactly the same effect, except that politically that wouldn't have been acceptable. But when you say it's a tariff, you actually end up making your supplier think about every which way to become even more efficient and protect their margin and still be able to sell it to you, goods to you cheaper. So I think that as long as the tariff regime continues, the effect really will be on the U.S. economy itself. It's not on the global economy, as it were. But I have this theory that I've been testing with a few people, a few top economists around the world. I've been saying that, there's so much liquidity in the U.S. market that this tariff period or this experimentation on the tariffs absorbs some of that liquidity off the market, which is a good thing because then that actually dampens inflation for a short while. So, that's the way I see it. I see that the net effect in the medium term may well be to create, ironically, a stronger U.S. economy rather than a weaker U.S. economy. But in the long term, it creates even more efficient producers around the world that the U.S. itself will not be able to compete with. This is the theory which I'm I've predicated my book on. The world is an evolving story, and we need to try and work out what is it evolving into. There was a time when the U.S. used to be the hotbed of manufacturing, hard manufacturing, cars, electronic goods, white goods, all of that. But as it tried to deal with the cost structure of its own manufacturing base, it exported the cost to other countries. And it punished its own workforce in the process, by keeping wages at 1995 levels to this day, and which is what creates the social upheavals you see in the U.S. today. Then you think about where it's heading. A lot of the discussions on the role of the U.S. Dollar and the strength of the U.S. economy tries to focus on trade. But the U.S. is not a behemoth on trade. Global trade is about $33 trillion, something like that. And China now makes a huge part of that. I think it's about 25% of global trade is China. And so China is the runaway winner when you look at the U.S., the global economy in the form of trade. But in the form of capital markets and its derivatives are multiple times the size of trade. And here, the U.S. dominates. And so the U.S. has moved from a manufacturing country to a services country to a capital markets country, economy. And that's where its strengths are. And it creates great upheavals even within the U.S. because if you have money, you will make more money by investing, right? And if you don't have money, you can't even enter the system. And so that's what creates homelessness in the U.S. And the U.S. as an economy, as a country, is willing to take that huge upheaval within its own society. It's able to accept it, still functions. If you had that level of dysfunctionality in an economy like China, you'll get a revolution. People will overthrow the government because they don't have the social mechanism to accept and handle it, and deal with it. And so the U.S. has moved into a realm as an economy that the rest of the world can only watch, and it still continues to be the world's most efficient capital markets. And in order to be the world's most efficient capital markets, it has to have a very transparent, rigorous information system, which it does, relative to the rest of the world. And so we see a lot of open-ended discussions, very transparent, fighting between different ideas and all of that in the U.S. And that's what contributes to the efficiency of the capital market. And the capital market depends on that. So it's, if you look at it in evolutionary terms, it's reached a level or a realm which it is a leader. But in doing that, it's given up services, it's given up manufacturing, and it's trying to recreate a little bit of that. It has to start thinking about how it can maintain its alpha role in capital markets, and then create relationships around the world that makes up for the things that it isn't. And it was doing quite well, but except that because it misinterpreted its own domestic social problems as something that has been imported from outside, that's why the confusion that we see today. And I must say this, that all our countries are making that evolution. All our countries are going from base manufacturing to high-tech manufacturing and then to improve our services. And China is actually between high-tech manufacturing and services right now. Mm. And once you enter the services realm, the next phase is to be a global capital markets player. Except that not every country has that information symmetry where information is free and available or by all parties in a transaction in order to be an efficient capital market. So that's how I see the evolution. And sometimes that whole process can take easily 10, 20 years before it works its way out. So that's how I track, what's happening worldwide. So even as I'm tracking the U.S., I'm also tracking China.
Well, yeah, I'd love to chat about that. Yeah. Talk to us a bit about sort of China's broader economic strategy and its geopolitical role in the world, because it's a very interesting topic.
In all the time that I've been, 25 years, sitting in China, talking to the economists, to the top economists in the National Development School and all of that, it has some of the best brains in the world, and they've made some of the most important decisions in their time that other countries can learn from. Before 2001, before they became a member of the WTO, they had already invested about 1976, 86, 96, 25 years in building a basic infrastructure of literacy. China has got a literacy of 96%. Compared to India, which is like only 60 something percent, and it's even lower for women, like 50. I mean, dramatically different between men and women. So when you reach that level of literacy, a number of options become possible for you, and your population is able to take on new technologies. A lot of the technology-driven innovations took place in the south of China, because that's where the entrepreneurial intent was, and it dove dovetailed with the West's view of being invested in China. So in the 2000s period, Wall Street had decided that it'll go to China, being the largest market in the world, to look for technology innovations that it can invest in. And when it found companies like Alibaba in a town called Hangzhou, and at the height of Alibaba's valuation on Wall Street, it was about $800 billion company. The effect it has on the local economy is that, I call it the cascading effect, which is an $800 billion company can invest in 100 $10 billion companies, which can invest in 1,000 $100 million companies and 10,000 small companies as a result. So the impact on the local economy was amazing. In fact, it just continues to this day. When we think about DeepSeek, it's also a Hangzhou company, and you can trace the cascading effect of capital down to the innovations that are taking place there. Over a period of time, China moved from, base manufacturing. It still is the most efficient manufacturer of everything in the world. And the thing that really impressed me about China is that despite having a large population, all of its population, as well as its leadership, embraced innovation and productivity wholeheartedly. In other words, a Chinese will think nothing about getting a machine to replace 200 workers. And if you go to many other countries, you go to Egypt, you go to India, you go to Indonesia, the politicians will tell you to think 10 times before you put a machine to replace people. And because of that embracing of technology, it made the country even more productive reassess the functions or the jobs that people took. So today you would find in the major cities that food delivery is a big business. In fact, nobody, I have an office in Beijing, nobody in my office steps out of the office to go to the shop downstairs to buy anything. They just apply for it on the app and it gets sent up immediately. So the workforce is very nimble in looking for where it gets its valuation and its wages and all of that. And then it continues to evolve. Today you have drones doing work, and even there the workforce will have to redefine itself as it goes goes along. And so it's going through that evolution. And I'll say this. My only concern about China is not the technology innovation, it's the governance structure that needs to sit on top of it as it becomes unmanageable. As more young people become more technology savvy, and as more young people, Facebook and LinkedIn and Google are banned in China, but the average Chinese still has more access to all of the things that happen around the world than an average American is even interested in. In other words, a Chinese today knows exactly what's going on in the US. Even for stand-up comedy, within 3 hours of it being published on YouTube, it gets published on Baidu and Bilibili or something like that, or some of the platforms that they have on shore. So the symmetry of global information is more or less equal, although China is a very controlled state at the social level. But as these young people, and it sends about 200 million young people out to study abroad, and then they come back, they are increasingly critical of the state. And you have a state mechanism where the governance structure is opaque, and that cannot continue. And so I think that's where China will have an issue that they will need to deal with. It's already had several flare-ups, like during COVID, when information wasn't forthcoming, and also when there was when they were able to close. They were able to close Wuhan, a city of 30 million people, for 3 months at the start of COVID in 2020. But by the time they came to Shanghai in 2022, there was, you know, great upheaval from the ground. You know, that there was a lot of dissatisfaction and anger in Shanghai, and the state knew that they couldn't continue with that policy. So the expectation of everyday people are changing, and I think that China will have to deal with that. Because of the opaqueness of the governance structure, many wealthy Chinese are exporting their wealth abroad, and the big beneficiary is here in Singapore. You know, the number of Chinese who move their wealth and try to get permanent residence in Singapore is off the scales at the moment, and that's just a description of the uncertainty that it introduces. And the problem is that because it doesn't have the institutions, the legal infrastructure, and the transparency of the state, every time there comes an inflection point, it deals with it quite badly. You know, so that's what the average Chinese has as is at the back of his mind of as a bad memory that he hopes that doesn't get, you know, affected. You know, and the thing about China is that you also need to look at it. If you zoomed out and you looked at it from the end of the Qing Dynasty in 1911 to what it is today, it had about more than half of that period. It was in turmoil. It wasn't a united country. And so it achieved that unity fairly recently, 1949. All right. And it values that achievement very deeply. And it's not going to give it up because it costs the state or the people so much to be what they are today. And so they tend to overreact in terms of you know, anything that will cause them to, you know, to disintegrate. There were a few attempts at liberalization. Tiananmen Square was one of them, and that didn't turn out well. And so the state has been postponing this need to make those decisions for institutional change, and it can't do that for too long. But on the technology front, on the innovation front, on corporate front, on capital flows front, it is a force to be reckoned with, you know, and that continues unabated. But the time has come for it to provide an alternative capital market to the Western model. One of the things that I find that I'm very intrigued by how the Chinese, and in fact, even the Singaporeans did, was that at the time of Reagan and Thatcher, when the Bank of England proposed this idea of the big bang approach to financial innovation, you know, the state should be asset light, it should sell all of its state-run institutions to third party, to the private sector, you know, and liberalize its capital markets. Russia bought into the big bang ideology hook, line, and sinker. Singapore was a little bit more tempered, but China looked at it and made a decision that it will take a tempered approach, where it took a dual approach, which was to create an open market so that price discovery became better, but at the same time, for essential services, it still remains state-sponsored. And because of that dual approach, it was able to import price discovery mechanisms into its economy. So food price, for example, is on a willing buyer, willing seller basis, which it wasn't before. It was a planned economy before. So making the transition from a planned economy to an open economy where the farmers could plant whatever they wanted and keep the profit was a transition that they needed to make very carefully, which they did. So I'm just intrigued by leadership which is able to look at where the global trends are and make a decision that is best suited for its own country. And as long as China is able to do that, they will evolve consistently. But there's always the danger of an inflection point where they really need a new business, a new model by which the system becomes more transparent and the governance structure is more professional.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. Around the world at the moment, the cost of living seems to be rising sharply, and it's leading to a lot of kind of a rise of sort of populism, economic nationalism, and sort of public discontent, especially in Europe and the US. I can't speak for Asia, but certainly in the US, Europe, and UK, it feels that way. So what are kind of the drivers of this, and are we really in a period of long-term economic decline, or are there things that are going to reverse that kind of course that we feel like we're on at the moment?
I think if you take Europe from 1989, Francis Fukuyama wrote the book, The End of History.
Yes.
Europe was congratulating itself that there was this huge dichotomy between, socialism and capitalism, thesis, antithesis, and we have reached thesis again. And they were congratulating themselves, not realizing that the rise of China was just ahead, and that was going to add a formula where everything that that Europe was able to do, China was going to be able to do cheaper, and that don't underestimate a country whose time has come. And in this case, this is easily a quarter of the global economy, and eventually did become a quarter of the global economy. I happen to come from a part of the world where we were able to pick and choose the policy options open to us, and use the ones that made sense, and then kept the ones that didn't make sense. When the Vietnam War was raging, and after the Vietnam War, when the huge the huge refugee population were leaving Vietnam, the Chinese especially, none of them made it to any of their neighboring countries, not Thailand, not Malaysia, not Singapore, not Indonesia. We kept them away. And that's because we were protecting our own jurisdictions, our own economies, our own social construct. We guarded our social construct very carefully. Liberal Europe, on the other hand, and North America, absorbed a lot of these refugees. And in the case of the U.S., it's predicated in the belief, in the firm belief that immigration is good for the economy, and it's a blanket statement. It doesn't even qualify the immigration that it takes in, good people, bad people, as long as you're suffering for whatever reason. And all of that comes with a cost. When Germany absorbed about 1 million Syrian refugees in 1 year, a country can't absorb, in a sustainable manner, that size of a immigrant population, undocumented, many of them. And so part of the European dilemma at the moment is dealing with an immigrant population that hasn't been absorbed into the economy. And that comes at the same time as the economy itself slowing down and dealing with external challenges where costs are much cheaper in other parts of the world. So I think that a new European ideology is required, where the European needs to express to himself, what is Europe? I also think that the West has bent over backwards, apologizing for what it has been from the period of the Industrial Revolution to where it is today, that it went around the world, looked for markets, conquered people, undermined entire civilizations, all of that. My answer to that is, if it wasn't the European, who would it be? If you take a country like India, it was effectively ruled by the Mughal kings from the northern part of India. If you go to Uzbekistan today, you have a very different view of India, because the Mughal kings from that part of the world were effectively ruling northern part of India. And India would have been a Muslim country today very, very easily. So we don't reconstruct history in the way that we want to. We just accept that things that have happened as they are, as they did, and then understand the mechanisms that drove that. And so the big thing about the Industrial Revolution was that, number one, small countries could be more efficient than large countries. And that's how a country like England could rule an entire continent like India. And I'm told that the East India Company, for example, which had stations right down to Indonesia and so on, and Macau and not Macau but Hong Kong, that it didn't have more than 1,000 offices. English officers, and a lot of its soldiers were actually Indian sepoys, that kind of thing. So it was able to manage a huge empire with the least number of people. And so that makes me think that with AI, we should be actually looking at smaller, smarter countries being able to harness AI to be able to be a bigger, big influence in large numbers of people around the world. So I worry for countries like Bangladesh, which has done very well in the manufacturing, and Indonesia, which have done well in the manufacturing phase of the global economy by just putting their people to work. And now with AI, you need fewer people. And so what does a factory look like going forward, right? So these are some of the elements that I have at the back of my mind when I think about where Europe is today, where a lot of the exemplary nation states are. Now, small nation states like Singapore, what we also did was we took the best of the British rule of law and social infrastructure, and we didn't change anything. We incorporated it, we copied it, and we improved on it. A lot of Fabian ideas actually work in Singapore. Every Singaporean has a CPF, a Central Provident Fund, a pension account, and all of that, and then they mix that with a Confucianist element in there, which says that each person must be responsible for his own life and his own old age. And so the decisions that you make for healthcare and so on is not a blanket check from the state. You have to be a co-contributor for you to understand what it's worth and so on. So there are countries like Singapore which have picked and chosen the things that works, and then blended that with Asian values, as it were, to be a functioning economy. But to be a winner economy, I think that with AI, you don't need to be a large country. You're looking for countries that are even more ruthless with productivity than the Industrial Revolution was. And the second thing about the Industrial Revolution was that innovations in technology, and I say this in my book, innovations in technology usually originates from liberal Western countries like the UK, the US, but the countries that actually perfect them are the more militant ones, the more organized ones, the ones that have got that were not very far off from a military structure, like Germany was, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Germany was well on its way to becoming the world's leading country. It was paying its debt and all of that, and so was Japan, because Japan, in the time of the Meiji Revolution, it still incorporated a lot of the samurai culture. So it was actually a military state right up to World War II, for good and bad reasons. But because it's a military state, it was able to absorb a lot of the innovations that were taking place. And today we see the same thing, that a lot of technology can emanate from the US, but the countries that perfect it are countries like China, which is far more organized, and is able to go deeper and in a much more focused manner. So I think that's a broad perspective of where we are globally, and where maybe the West is globally. Yeah.
Well, if we fast forward 10 years, what are the three biggest shifts that you think we'll see in global finance and geopolitical power?
The big one is the huge battle between centralization and decentralization in finance. Those of you who are not in finance will understand this differently, in that it's the platform economy and the personalization economy. So in the last 10 years, no, last 20 years, you know, from the time of the start of Google and then on to Amazon and so on, it was all about big businesses using the platform economy, which was originated by Tim Berners-Lee in passing, because I know Tim, and he wrote the code for HTTP, which is the code on which all of the internet operates today. So you have huge companies like Amazon that sits on it, and Microsoft and everybody, and he got nothing for it, right? So that was the last 20, 30 years, which was to onboard as many customers as possible and then to monetize them. Mm-hmm. But with blockchain technology, we are now seeing an ability of individuals, you and I, instead of being onboarded to a generic platform, we can actually create our own platforms and our own communities. So the power of the relationship moves from platforms and from generic huge companies to the individual. And that's why the title of my book is The Personalization of Finance is Here. But after I wrote my book, when I was studying some of the personalization technologies, I realized how difficult it was to make personalization a reality. And the reason is that technology innovation requires investments, which are usually driven by venture capitalists who want a return on their investments. And there's always this desire that the platform approach enables large corporations to rule the roost, to have the power concentrated on them. So there's a power game going on right now between the individual and the large corporations on the platform economy. How this power game will evolve over time will be an interesting development that we need to understand. There was a US think tank researcher who suggested in the 1990s, and I mentioned this in my book, that the world is going through, the world has gone through four phases of evolution, society. From tribal, we became institutional. We institutionalized our tribalism. We institutionalized religion and language and schools and all of that. And then from institutions, we created markets. And it's not like we've left our tribal phase. We have a lot of our tribal underpinnings still there. We haven't left our institutional phase. We are still driven by institutions. But now we're in a market space where we're able to buy and sell from people for very far away from us because it's a trusted element that we've created. There are institutions that operate at a market level. The thing about market space is that, when we trade with each other, it's always a willing buyer, willing seller, which is, you have something, I have something, we trade, and then there's an exchange, and there's a buyer, seller, winner, loser. We're now entering the fourth phase, which this writer says is the networked phase. And this is something which the developments in this area are things that people who exist in the institutional and the market space just can't understand or appreciate. So when we have an asset like Bitcoin, for example, going up in value dramatically, the people who are buy and sell ordinary shares, including Warren Buffett, and Charlie Munger, they're upset that there's something called Bitcoin. They don't understand it. They don't trust it. And yet, it's now a highly institutionalized ecosystem where people trust each other, and the value they give to a digital asset is the value that they share with each other on the network. And we'll see more of that as we evolve. So these two developments will get translated into how countries are organized, how economies are organized. One of the things that always thrills me is when I walk through a airport or a huge fancy shopping mall, and then you see all these huge brands, Bulgari and Hermes and all of that, Loro Piano and so on, and it just the names get even more frightening as I mention them, because the prices of the things, of the luxury goods in them, are outrageous. And then when you think about the cost of production is actually nothing, then you ask yourself what it is that makes society give them these things the value that they have. And that's because we are valuing perception. We are valuing, mutual validation. Those are intangible valuations that we are adding to our idea of what an economy is. And that's where Bitcoin and digital assets are getting their valuations from. And so these are the two things. The ideas that I'm talking to you about may sound esoteric, but they drill down into how entire countries are organized and will be organized in the future.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add today before we wrap up?
I'm writing my second book, which goes more into geopolitics. I originally titled it The Winning State, but I think I have to think of a better name. basically, how innovations in finance are creating the states that are going to ace the process, and they're not necessarily the large states.
Thank you so much for your time, Manuel. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, the best place is to start with emmanueldaniel.com. That's my blog. And then from there, if there's something that I've done somewhere else, you can find your way from there.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Chris.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.